I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, it's Midday on Ethics. We consider the poignant story of Jahi McMath, a California girl who raised tough questions for doctors, religious groups, and the courts about what it means to live and to die and who gets to decide how to define life and death. Plus, can anyone be forced to be a parent? What if a couple undergoing IVF treatment divorces, but one person wants to use leftover embryos to have a baby? A new law in Arizona turns the current legal consensus on its head. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics joins me. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Judy and the General at Baltimore's Spotlighters Theater. Now, some random kids.
Midday starts right after the news.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's another edition of Midday on Ethics. We're going to explore some of the ethical questions pulled straight from the headlines. We'll begin with the story of Jahi McMath. She's a 13-year-old girl in California who was declared dead in December 2013 after a routine surgery went wrong. And then last month, 4.5 years later, she was declared dead again in New Jersey. It's a tragic story that raises issues about end of life that has pitted the medical profession against people with deeply held religious beliefs. Just like there is no consensus on when life begins, we're finding that there's also a lack of agreement about when life ends. How do we define death? And who gets to define it? Another story caught our eye as well. Infertile couples who undergo IVF treatment often have leftover embryos, which are saved for possible future use in hopes of achieving pregnancy. If those couples split up, the legal consensus has been that the embryos cannot be used unless both people agree, on the theory that nobody can be forced to be a parent. Well, a new law in Arizona turns that legal consensus on its head. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me here in Studio A. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He stops by from time to time to help us explore how ethicists frame these kinds of very complex questions. Good to see you, sir.
Good to be here.
And listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on our conversation here, our number at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. So, Jeff, let's recap for listeners who may not be familiar with this really tragic story in California. This young girl, 13 years old, goes into a hospital in California for a tonsillectomy. She had sleep apnea, and they just were going to remove her tonsils and do some other things. It's a pretty routine operation, but as we are reminded in this case, you know, once you're put under general anesthesia and they start messing with you, nothing is routine in a certain level.
Yeah, so you're right. It's a really tragic case. So it's an unfortunate death. She actually survived the surgery and anesthesia, but there were some complications after she woke up. Her family, who was there, noticed that she was bleeding inordinately. I think her mother, in fact, is a nurse, and alerted the caregivers, and the argument is that they didn't respond quickly enough. And so by the time they attended to her, her brain had been deprived of oxygen for such a period of time that she had crossed over into what is called in the medical profession death by brain criteria, brain death. So certain functions of her brain were deemed to be irreversibly ceased. They didn't work anymore. And we can talk about the history of this, but it's a longstanding policy in every state in the United States that you can be declared dead either the old way, when your heart stopped beating and you stopped breathing. So that's determined as whole body death, or death by brain criteria. And the idea there really is your heart may still be beating and you still may be breathing, sometimes on your own, sometimes with the aid of a ventilator, but the person is gone, right? So that's the interesting distinction. So the body may still be alive, but the person is irreversibly gone. And at that point, a person can be declared dead and a death certificate can be issued. And so this story is one where the family disagreed with that assessment. So neurologically, and through the process that's always applied, it was determined by the medical professionals that Jahai's brain function had irreversibly ceased in these ways that she met the criteria for brain death. And the family just didn't agree with that. And so they opted, went to court first to allow them to take what the hospital in Oakland deemed to be a corpse at that point and move her to a state that had a more permissive policy. And you mentioned she was declared dead a second time in New Jersey. That's relevant because New Jersey and New York are the only states that actually have this policy where families can opt out of determination of death by brain criteria on religious grounds. It's really to accommodate Orthodox Jewish beliefs about whole body death being the only way to define death. And so they were able to move her from Oakland, where she was deemed to be dead, to New Jersey, where they could opt out of that definition. And she was maintained in an apartment with round-the-clock care for 4 more years until she died of other causes, and not deemed by brain criteria, but by whole body death.
Yeah, she died of liver failure ultimately, and it was just a month or so ago.
Right.
And the difference, I read an article in Dome Magazine, which is a publication at Johns Hopkins Medicine, and full disclosure, my wife, Lynelle Smith, is the editor of that magazine, but Karen Nitkin did a really interesting piece in November of last year about this, and one of the physicians she quotes in it mentions that because of technology, the lines between life and death are now much blurrier than they used to be. I mean, it used to be that whole body death or perhaps even brain death was easier to determine back in the day. But now with ventilators and stuff like that and with other technological assessment tools, it's stickier, isn't it? It's not so
much,
easy.
Right. And truthfully, in a way, the technological turning point, to use your term, was when mechanical ventilation became available, so people could be maintained artificially with machines in ways that just weren't possible before. But that goes back to the 1960s. And so at that point, there needed to be a decision made about when it was appropriate to remove that artificial support. And there's a famous case in my world, and people probably of a certain age will know this name, of Karen Ann Quinlan, who was a young woman who suffered a car accident, ended up in a ditch with water at the bottom of the ditch and deprived of oxygen for some period of time. When she was found, it had been a long enough time that she didn't wake up, but she was maintained by an artificial mechanical ventilator and her family said she wouldn't want to live this way. She's never going to wake up. We want to remove the ventilator. And the courts didn't know what to do with a request like that because it had never come up before. And so absolutely right, in response to your comment, these weren't issues until we had the technology that made them issues. Now, brain death is a somewhat different story, actually.
And can you be considered brain dead if you are breathing without the aid of a ventilator?
Yes, sometimes. So not always. But again, it's sort of not a very bright line set of criteria that way. I mean, there's a very clear sense of criteria that need to be met that are assessed neurologically. But you can breathe on your own. A body can breathe on its own and still be declared dead by brain criteria. And part of that is it's a social construction of death, right, rather than a physical definition of death. No one would argue that when you held the candle under the nose of a body, if the flame didn't flicker, right, then you sort of wouldn't say that person was still alive. They weren't breathing anymore. That was in ancient times a test of whether a person was alive anymore. And when the body grew cold, right? I mean, there's sort of nothing anybody would argue about that body is still alive. But when the body is warm, it continues to breathe, whether through mechanical ventilation or not, and the heart continues to beat, it's hard for people to get their heads around the fact that can be a dead body. And that's because we created this social definition of death having to do with a distinction between a body and the person that inhabited that body. It's a Cartesian, going back to Descartes, right? The philosopher, the mind-body distinction. And that's part of Western culture that has been long adopted, but the definition of how to measure that that time has come is not challenged so much, but it's difficult for people to accept sometimes. The other piece of this is an important part of the story is that organ transplant from deceased donors was made possible by that definition, because that way organs could be removed from a body that continued to perfuse those organs. So the heart continued to beat, the lungs continued to breathe, and that person was declared dead. And that way the organs could be taken from that body and transplanted into somebody else. If you waited for whole body death, it's called cold ischemic time. The organs aren't usable anymore because they haven't been perfused.
And part of the calculation has to do with chances of recovery. And it seems to me that in Jahi McMath's case, her mother, for whatever reason, thought that she had the chance to get better. She was on a ventilator, I guess, right? And she was in New Jersey, but they moved her to New Jersey for the reasons you talked about, because of the legal distinction between Jersey and New York law as opposed to California. And her mother, up to the time of her death last month, asserted that she was getting better. So she believed in her heart, for whatever reasons, and you can only imagine the kind of stress and terrible daily tension and difficulty she had for these last 4.5 years, particularly when she thought there was a cause of this situation, and that's a whole other issue too, what she thought the hospital should have done and didn't do, which caused her daughter's condition. But she believed that Jahi had the possibility of getting better. To what extent do medical professionals take that into consideration? I mean, is brain death a declaration that they say there is no chance whatsoever that this person will improve?
Yes. The way you just articulated it is the criteria. So irreversible cessation of certain functions of the brain, and those are well-defined. Now, the challenge isn't that definition and that criteria. It's how to measure that. And part of the disagreement in the Jahi McMath case was that the family felt like they didn't believe that she met those criteria. And then when they took her to New Jersey, they believed that she was able to actually respond to their questions and stimuli and interact with them, albeit in a very limited way, by squeezing hand or having some twitch of a finger, but they believed that to be in response to the questions that they were asking her, or the comments that they were making, or her response to, how are you feeling today? And there were people in the medical community who actually were not sure that she met the criteria of brain death. So that's part of what makes this a really challenging story. So the family was not convinced and didn't accept the definition, and there were even some in the medical community who, upon following her case over these last 4 years, were also not convinced that she met those criteria. And part of the challenge is the measurements of when a patient crosses over are just not that exact and not that specific. So it's a prediction, as you put it, but it's a prediction about whether there will ever be recovery of that brain function. And the answer has to be no for the death certificate to be signed.
At Hopkins, as Karen Nitkin reports in her Dome piece, there's something called the Neurological Criteria Support Team. So the determination about that irreversibility is not necessarily made by the surgeon who performed whatever operation or the primary care physician. It's made by a separate group of people who are brought in to consult. So how do they function?
And that's typical. Maybe call it something different in different environments, but there's a separation of the determination of death, that group of neurologists, and it's multiple people over multiple times to make sure that there's a consistency, and it isn't somebody who's caring for the patient. So there's an independence.
And they're neurologically trained. They're correct. Not necessarily trained as general surgeons or heart surgeons or cancer surgeons.
No, it's a neurological determination, because that's what's being, right, that's what's in question here, is whether the brain is continuing to function in particular ways. And so they are brought in, as I said, to make an assessment, and then they do that over a period of time, not just one point in time. And there needs to be agreement over the, both a period of time and by the people who do it. And only then is there a determination that death should be announced at that time. And then a death certificate is issued. And that's where you get the notion of the date and time of death, and why it's such an odd case in the Jahi McMath example, where she was declared dead twice in different states, 4 years apart. I mean, it's really unusual.
Yeah, and her attorneys are working now to have the first death certificate essentially annulled. I mean, they want to reverse that. They want to get rid of that so that her date and time of death is June of 2018, not back in 2013. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about this. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. To join our conversation, you can call us at 410-662-8780, to send us an email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @midday WYPR, to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our broadcast tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap. We're going to talk about President Trump and his latest controversies and what the staff reductions at the New York Daily News might mean for the Baltimore Sun. The Sun is owned by the same company that made the cuts in New York. They're called Tronc. And we're going to talk about the future of local news around the country. Plus, we'll have a conversation with Kimberly Reed. She's the producer of a powerful new film about the influence of money in politics. It's called Dark Money. It opens at the Parkway Theater here in Baltimore tomorrow night, and we'll have a preview tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the ethical questions raised by a couple of issues in the news lately, including the tragic case of a young African-American 13-year-old girl, Jahi McMath. She was on life support and declared brain dead 4.5 years ago in California, but she was kept alive for the last 4.5 years, partially because of her mother's disagreement with the determination that she was, in fact, brain dead. She was moved to New Jersey, where she did die of liver failure just last month. So, Jeff Kahn, and by the way, if you'd like to join our conversation, let me give you the phone numbers again, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and you can also ping us on Facebook. We're streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. You mentioned that the neurological teams that come in hospitals across the country, they have different people come in at different times because there is the possibility that brain function and brain cessation is temporary. Sometimes it does come back. So if you just do it once and say, okay, now we're done, that doesn't prove that. But if you do it once and then you wait, I think on Hopkins the standard is about 6 hours, and then you do it a couple more times, then you can have an understanding of it. And I was fascinated to read in Karen Nitkin's article in Dome that oftentimes the neurological team has to do almost as much convincing to the primary care team, to the other medical professionals, as they do to the family.
Which I think is a indication of how much the healthcare professionals care about the people that they're caring for, which should make us all feel good, right? That they're advocating for us as patients, and they're invested in the good outcome of the people that they're caring for, and so again, it also I think brings up the point that we've been talking about throughout this conversation, which is the fuzziness of these definitions, because they're created by us. They're in some sense not the natural definition of death, which is whole body, It's a societal definition of death. And that's, you know, indicated by the fact that we have different policies in different states in the U.S. and different policies in different countries in the world. We're all humans and inhabit the same planet. But if you're in Japan, this is not a policy that is applied. They don't believe in declaration and definition of death through brain criteria. Whereas here in the U.S., Canada, and most European countries, that is the way.
So in Japan, there's no question. If your brain is not functioning, but you're able to breathe and your heart is still beating, you're alive.
You continue to be alive, right?
Yeah.
And so they, as a function of that, and it's slowly changing, but as a function of that, they don't have organ donation from deceased donors. They can't, right? One goes with the other. And so they have we have a shortage of solid organs for transplant in this country, even though we have death by brain criteria. In Japan, it's much more acute because they don't have organ donation that way.
Some of the other conditions that physicians and families have to deal with is people can be in a coma, but that's different than brain death. They can be in what's called a vegetative state, and they can have something called locked-in syndrome. Walk us through how those three things differ.
Sure, with a very large caveat that I'm not a neurologist nor a physician, so this is from my work on the policy side of these issues. So a coma, people are probably familiar with, is usually something that people can recover from, but sometimes you hear they didn't ever wake up from a coma, but there's a sense that that's not terminal, right? That's transitory. Persistent vegetative state is what it sounds like. It's not quite brain death, but it's a person who is in a persistent, won't recover state that's in between. They're not aware of their surroundings, but they're not yet meeting the criteria of death by brain criteria. There's a famous case of a woman who was in that state named Terry Schiavo, which people may remember.
Who was in that state for 15 years.
Correct.
1990 to 2005.
Right.
She was 26 years old. And this is a case in which the family disagreed. You had the husband disagreeing with the parents of Ms.
Right. And the husband saying she wouldn't want to be maintained in this state. And the parents saying, we don't care what you think. We want to keep her alive. And then locked-in syndrome is, by general definition, an inability to communicate, but an ability to experience one's surroundings. So you know what's going on around you, but you can't communicate, which one imagines about the scariest of anything one could imagine, right? People don't know that you're aware, and you can't communicate that you are, but you are fully aware of what's going on around you. So there is some interesting research being done now in the neuroscience area to try to better understand some objective criteria for measuring these things by doing functional magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, so putting people into an MRI machine in real time, asking them questions and then watching what goes on in their brain, by watching what lights up in terms of the parts of their brain that are active, as a way of trying to match up the areas we know light up when people interact or are aware of their surroundings, and trying to determine whether that is indicative of the person's ability to be aware but not communicate necessarily. So trying to be more refined about some of these definitions.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Jeff is the head of the Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming as we speak. You mentioned that, you know, death by brain criteria, thank you, is a societal determination. And there are societal dimensions of this case with Jahi McMath, the girl from California who ended up dying in New Jersey. She is African-American. The family has a suspicion an assumption or an assertion that had she been a white kid, this might have been handled differently. That's a real thing. The financial obligation of the hospital in California, were they not to have declared her brain dead in December of 2013 would have been very different. I guess the care for her, keeping her on a ventilator and, you know, having 24-hour care would have fell to the state or to the hospital. So there are those who say, you know, there's a financial incentive for the state of California to say, nope, she is dead by brain criteria and we're finished here. So it's not just a cut and dry medical thing. It's not just what the beeping machines say, is it?
Yeah. I will say that I think there are safeguards in place to prevent the decisions from being made based on financial criteria, right? There are, as we have already talked about, teams that are charged with making the determination strictly on medical grounds. I think there absolutely in this case was a sense of mistrust and distrust on the part of the family of the hospital and of the system. I'm not sure it was about that particular hospital, but rather they were mistrustful of the way that they were being treated within the medical system, and I think well-founded for African Americans in this country. It actually plays out in a variety of ways. So it's not as unusual in cases of African Americans not believing the definition of death. And there's certainly an underrepresentation of African-American organ donors in this country, motivated by the same sorts of concerns about not treating as aggressively, because that's a way to get to my organs more quickly, right? And it's an unfortunate part of the social history of this country, that, like a lot of things, overlay the way we interact with each other and how institutions interact with certain subsets of our society. It's not right. It's not defensible. But it is a feature of the healthcare system, like a lot of other parts of our society.
Well, it's just such a sad situation, and it's not over yet by any means. So this story will continue to play out. As we mentioned, they're trying to get the death certificate in California thrown out and make the New Jersey one be the one that prevails. So we'll see what happens with there. I want to talk now about another story that we thought about, and this is a new law in Arizona, and critics of the law are decrying it as what they're calling forced parentage. And just as we're talking here about how it's difficult to determine the exact moment of death, of course, there's been a longstanding disagreement about the exact moment of life. So this is has to do with embryos that are harvested for the purpose of in vitro fertilization. And the idea heretofore, before this Arizona law, is that a couple owns these embryos, has custody of these embryos. If the couple breaks up, the only way the embryos can be used for the purpose of creating a pregnancy is if both the husband and the wife, or now the ex-husband and ex-wife, agree. But the Arizona law said, nope, we're going to change the rules. Tell us about that.
Yeah. And this is an issue that has been one recognized in the clinics that make embryos by IVF, and by the people who engage in these practices, the folks who work on the ethics and law and policy in this issue. And now there's a standard part of the consent process where you actually need, as you sign on to the services, say what you want to happen if you break up. So if a couple breaks up, what should happen to the embryos? And you decide that, you sign a contract, it's clear. That way we don't have disagreements like this. But even with that, there are still disagreements, as you wouldn't be surprised to learn, where couples break up and somebody wants something different than what was in that signed contract. And up till now, the courts have said the contract prevails. It's what it says there, and you need to abide by that. And that has always been both people have to agree. And if they don't, then the person who doesn't want them used tends to win. Arizona flipped it on its head, as you said in the intro, and has now said effectively the embryos deserve the opportunity to be brought into to become a baby. And so if a person wants to use them for that purpose, they win, independent of whatever the contract might have said. So it's a kind of pro-life argument about what should happen to the embryos that are left over after couples have gone through IVF.
And we're talking about millions of embryos. I mean, this is not like seven embryos someplace in Arizona.
Yeah.
That millions are frozen and, you know, potentially usable for the purpose of creating a pregnancy across the country.
Correct. Literally millions, you're right. And the exact number is not known. And this is the law in one state, which is making its way through challenges. So it became law in Arizona first part of July. So it was passed by the legislature in Arizona, signed by the governor. It's being challenged in court by a couple that ended up being sort of the impetus for this law. But everybody's watching it very carefully because it is so much so different and so opposite what has been the prevailing legal view about what to do in cases like this. And so it's an important one to watch, because if it turns out to be upheld, then one imagines other states that would also follow it, and we'll end up with a funny patchwork where in some states you can be obligated to be a parent, as you put it, and in other states it's quite the opposite.
So in this case, this stems of the law in Arizona, which, as you mentioned, just went into effect July 1st of this year, stems from a divorce case, and the divorce case hasn't finished yet. They're still battling it out in the court. The woman in this couple wants to use the embryo to have it implanted in another woman's womb and have the pregnancy come to term. The male in this
ex-husband
does not, right? The male would have no financial or legal responsibility for a child, but it is the male's child. I mean, mm-hmm. This is an inseminated embryo that would be, right, implanted,
his,
right? That's how IVF works.
His sperm, her eggs are combined in a petri dish. That's the in vitro part. So it's sort of helping what nature would otherwise make possible, right? And so some number of embryos were made that way. They attempted to get pregnant with them, I assume, and didn't work. Or maybe they had children and they didn't decide to have any more, got divorced, and there are some left over and frozen, right? So the woman from the couple could say, I want to implant them and have more children with them. I'm half the biological, part of the story here. And in most cases, the answer would be no. The former husband, who would be the father, biologically speaking, the father of the child, needs to agree. You can't make him be a father without his consent. And Arizona is saying, no. The embryo gets to be—
has rights just as much as the mother or the father.
They don't use the term has rights, but that's certainly where it's headed. And that's why it's really interesting. Because if you start asserting that embryos have rights, there are millions of them. It has very large implications for the abortion debate, as you've intimated. And so it's got big policy implications, not only for Arizona.
Yeah, in this divorce case, the woman says, look, I was awarded custody of the dog, but I don't have custody of these embryos. All right? And you're right, this is becoming a test case, or it looks like it's churning up to be a test case about when does life begin? Do embryos have the sort of human rights that a fetus has, or that a born child has?
A fetus doesn't really either. I mean, we should be careful about that language, right? So that's what the abortion debate is about. At what point does the state have an interest in intervening on behalf of a developing human life? And so at fertilization, the answer seems to be no. It hasn't been up till now. And in fact, Roe v. Wade, which, we're hearing much more about with the Brett Kavanaugh nomination to the Supreme Court. Roe v. Wade said in the first trimester, certainly the woman has, the decision is hers. There is no state interest in intervening on behalf of the developing life. Only at the beginning of the second into the third trimester, and different conditions depending on how far in development, does the state have a compelling interest to intervene on behalf of the developing life and trump the decision of the woman who's carrying that fetus in her body, right? That's where the tension arises. It's my body. It's something is growing in my body. I get to decide what happens to it up to a point. And what that point is what's at issue.
Sure, and of course, Mr. Kavanaugh, you know, has given indications that he thought Roe v. Wade was not decided correctly, and if he is in fact appointed to the Supreme Court, if this case, this case in Arizona, gets to the Supreme Court, we could have a really interesting situation. There, a couple of friends of the court briefs have said that it's exceedingly painful. It could be exceedingly painful to have children born against your wishes. And many states, Massachusetts, Tennessee, Jersey, California, they have been swayed by that argument. They've said, you know, yeah, it is. It would be painful to have a child that you did not wish to have. Nothing against the child, but you don't, you know, having a child also has to do with raising a child and being in a couple that had at one time, you know, seen fit to try to do that. But if that circumstance changes, your decision about fatherhood or motherhood could change as well.
Right. And would have dramatic implications for how people thought about their making embryos by IVF. So maybe you would say, I'm only willing to make the number that we're going to implant now while we're married, right? We won't make any extras and freeze them because I don't want to be in this situation, right? There would be actions and behaviors that would people would take very understandably to avoid being placed in a position, whether they have financial obligations or not, right? Being made a parent without their consent. And that seems antithetical, frankly, to the way we have thought about reproductive rights in this country. Right, it has been mostly about women's rights for obvious reasons, but now this starts to invoke both parts of the of the biological equation.
Balancing the interests of each spouse if they have a disagreement about this. What's the medical criteria? Or what's the medical dimension of that argument? Meaning, if you don't make sort of more than you need, more if you don't have a stockpile of these embryos in the IVF process, does that limit your capacity to succeed in that process medically?
Sure. So the reason we have so many millions left over and frozen is because up till very recently, every egg that was collected, harvested in the course of a hyperovulation, which is what happens when women go in for IVF, their bodies are made to produce more eggs than they otherwise would in a given cycle, in a given month. They're all collected and they all would be fertilized because you can freeze an embryo very successfully. That's why there are so many frozen, and thaw them, implant them, and have a baby with them. But until very recently, you could not freeze and thaw and fertilize an egg. So all the eggs collected needed to be fertilized if you wanted to keep them. Otherwise, they were wasted. Now, I think we would end up, if this policy in Arizona becomes more widespread, you would collect eggs, only fertilize those eggs that would be implanted that cycle, freeze the eggs. And then in the future, if someone wanted to use their eggs, a woman wanted to use her eggs and get a sperm donor or her new husband or a partner to fertilize them, that could be done. But you wouldn't obligate the person who had been your husband to be a father because his sperm would not have been used.
And different courts, lower level courts than the Supreme Court, have decided these things differently. That's fascinating. In Illinois and Pennsylvania, they've awarded the embryos to the women because they couldn't otherwise reproduce. In other cases, the courts have ordered that the embryos be donated to research or that they remain frozen indefinitely until maybe the couple will reconcile, you know?
Yeah.
So the court is saying, we don't know what might happen a year from now, 3 years from now, but it is the embryo is no less likely or unlikely to produce a baby in 3 years than it is in 1 year, right?
I mean, they can remain frozen for many years,
yeah.
20 years, really quite a long time. And to the point you raised earlier, there's a question about how embryos that are frozen left over ought to be treated as a matter of law. Are they property? So you made that you quoted, I think.
Yeah, custody of the embryos.
Right. So do you take custody of embryos? Are they treated as property? Are they like your dog? Right. They're a pet, but they're not. They don't have rights like a human does. Or should they get some other status? So we haven't really gotten to the bottom of that debate, or it hasn't been resolved. And one imagines that's a highly political one. It isn't something that will be resolved based on data.
Yeah, and as is always the case, every time we talk, we don't resolve it here either.
That keeps me coming back.
That's right.
It's part of my job.
Indeed. We have to face the resolution, however, that we're out of time. So, Jeffrey Kahn, it's always good to see you. Thank you so much, and we'll see you the next time.
I look forward to it.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us every couple of months for Midday on Ethics. He is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we've got links to the Berman Institute on our website, wipr.org/Midday. Quick break, and then theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with a review of Judy and the General at the Spotlighters Theater here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.